From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Comeback is a new HBO comedy series satirizing the world of television. It stars Lisa Kudrow as an actress trying to revive her career by taking a part in a new sitcom while making a companion reality show about her comeback. The Comeback was co-created by Kudrow and Michael Patrick King after the conclusion of their own successful series. Kudrow played Phoebe on Friends. King was an executive producer and writer on Sex and the City. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Kudrow and King. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new CDs from Coldplay and Dressy Bessie, and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Vindication, A Life of Mary Wollstonecraft. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
This is my comeback. All right, now I'm going to let me take that again, okay? So this is my Jane, I'm sorry. The camera keeps moving in and out.
It's is always going to be moving. Just keep going.
No, yeah, oh, I know. It's just, I don't know if I should wait for it to settle or...
That's Lisa Kudrow in the first episode of The Comeback, a new HBO comedy series satirizing the world of television. Kudrow plays Valerie Cherish, an actress who used to be a sitcom star and is now starring in a reality series documenting her attempt to make a comeback in a new sitcom called Room and Board. Her part on Room and Board ends up being a small one, and the cameras from the reality show are always around to document each of her major and minor humiliations. The Comeback was co-created by Kudrow and Michael Patrick King after ending their own very successful series. Kudrow played Phoebe on Friends. King was a writer and executive producer of Sex and the City. He's writing and directing episodes of The Comeback in addition to serving as executive producer with Lisa Kudrow. The fourth episode of The Comeback will debut this Sunday on HBO. Lisa Kudrow, Michael Patrick King, welcome back to Fresh Air. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
How did you team up? I mean, you were from different shows. It's not like you'd worked together. So how'd you team up?
Actually, we knew each other before our illustrious shows separated us and brought us back together. I knew Lisa from a long time ago when she was a member of the Groundling comedy troupe. And a friend of mine was in the troupe as well, and I went to see her one night. And the thing I remember the most about the night was she did an impression of Audrey Hepburn on a rural fishing show. And it was the most bizarrely subtle, bizarre sketch I'd ever seen. And all I remember is her sitting poised in the middle of between these two hillbillies doing a perfect comedy Audrey Hepburn. And I thought, she is really different.
Aw.
So you were already friends and you decided that maybe you should get together for a new show?
Well, we were already friends. And we'd run into each other at award shows, you know, where Sex and the City would literally trample over Friends to get up on stage and collect their award.
That's right. That's exactly the way I like to remember it.
And then, you know, we have the same agents. And, you know, they said, hey, you're both available. Why don't you have lunch? And we did. And, you know, Michael looked at me and said, you seriously want to do another TV show? I said, well, the only show I would do is this. And I did this character that I had done in The Groundlings. Michael hadn't seen that one. And just, you know, I had this sort of messy idea, you know, on a reality show. She's starting a new sitcom. And he went, wait, oh, my God. And just started organizing it, putting it together, giving it a shape and just more of a, like, significant context, you know?
Yeah, but first came the laughing.
Yeah,
I mean,
well.
Lisa started to do this character that was incredibly deluded in her own self-worth and thinking she was on top of everything she was saying. And it was just so, vulnerable and funny and pretentious that I just started laughing. And I have a background in improv as well. So she actually sat at the table and said, all I have is this character that I have an impulse and I think it's funny. And then I started asking her questions and then she started improvising. And then I realized if I was the waiter asking this character question, it was funny. And then if I was, I don't know, a cop asking this, not that I do a great cop or anything.
Oh, you do a great cop, Michael.
It's an Irish guy, an Irish cop. But Lisa was just able to always make me laugh doing this character. And the only downside about it was that it was an actress. And we thought, oh, it's an actress character. And she has to be an actress because that's part of her pathology, is that she wants attention and she wants to present herself as something. Then we started thinking, well, how can we do this and go further than just an actress and in television? And then we started thinking, well, what is television about right now? And we both agreed that what it was about was kind of the war between reality shows and sitcoms, and also the war between, you know, dignity and humility and humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So we started
with
digging
humiliation
around.
Humiliation winning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
but it is.
It does win. It wins every week on many, 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 many reality shows. Humiliation wins.
So, Lisa, could you give us an illustration of the character that you presented to Michael Patrick King?
Oh, it's in every episode. It's exactly, she's completely intact, you know. Let's see, when I first started I don't know exactly what I said at the lunch, but, you know, this woman who feels like she's on top of everything and, you know, takes her time to come up with very thoughtful, just the right word, and it ends up being something like, you know, it's something that I think is very important. And then she underlines it as if.
She also had this this impulse that she was always very important. Like there was this one improv Lisa did where she was saying something about cancer, like at a benefit. And she said, what did you say, Lisa?
I don't remember.
You said cancer. It's a killer, and we got to get that word out there.
Gotta get the word out.
Gotta get the word out.
So know that people know. It's important to shine a spotlight on. Yeah, you know, she just, as if she's delivering important news for the first time to everybody.
Now, the character you play in The Comeback, Valerie Cherish, is first auditioning and then gets the part in a new sitcom. And the sitcom is supposed to be about four sexy singles who are roommates. But while shooting the pilot, the writers realize that this isn't going to work because you, Lisa Kudrow, your character is like older than the 20-somethings, the attractive 20-somethings who are in this sitcom. So they decide to make you Aunt Sassy. You're, instead of the roommate, now you're the aunt who lives upstairs. Now, I'd like to play the scene in which the writers tell Valerie, the Lisa Kudrow character, that that she's being changed from a roommate to the aunt who lives upstairs, and it's going to be a much smaller part. So here's the scene.
So what's up, boss?
It isn't working. The network thought that the four-girl thing was tired, so we're just going to make some changes to the script. No one was buying you living with these kids.
Uh-huh.
So now it's two young girls and two young guys, and you're the aunt who lives upstairs.
Okay. Boom. Yeah. So much information. My head's gonna explode, you know. Okay, so, all right, so now I'm the aunt?
Mm-hmm. Aunt Sassy.
Okay, whose aunt? Does it matter?
Cassie's aunt.
Uh-huh. Oh, so Juno's not fired.
No. Oh, God. Everyone thinks Juno's a star.
Oh, good, good. Yeah. Well, me too. Yeah.
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 Look. We wanted to find a way to cement you into the show.
Uh-huh.
So your Aunt Sassy, who mm-hmm. lives upstairs and owns the building.
Okay, all right, so she owns the building and she's an architect. Did she design the building?
No, we dropped the architect thing. See?
You did.
We want to use you whenever we want to use you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a job, it'd be all sorts of chuffa
right.
about why you weren't working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, because on It, I had...
This isn't a workplace comedy.
Yeah, well, not today, but who knows what's coming tomorrow, right? But, I know what you're saying, though, yeah. But it's just on It, you know, I worked, but they still managed to write me into every scene somehow. Mm. But, no, I understand. This is not a workplace comedy, so, yeah, I get it. Okay. All right, so, I'm an aunt, still sexy, smart, and...
Yeah, and an aunt.
Right.
Yes. Who she owns the building. I mean, that too.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah, she owns the building. Yeah, I can relate to that. Yeah, because, you know, well, I mean, I'm not an aunt, but I own some apartment buildings.
Oh, do you really? Oh, that's great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So if you need any input, you know, be happy to give you some. Okay,
definitely.
Good.
That's Lisa Kudrow in a scene from The Comeback, and Lisa Kudrow co-created the show with my guest, Michael Patrick King. Lisa Kudrow and Michael Patrick King are my guests. This is a really funny scene. It's also a kind of sad scene for the Valerie character because she's being so offended in such euphemistic ways.
Right.
Yeah.
The thing that struck me when I heard the clip without seeing the picture, what really jumps out is that the silences are really long.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the signature things that's really kind of hard, I think, about the show is that we don't try to move through stuff fast. We let her sit in the uncomfortable pain of it.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested in hearing how this scene looks from each of your points of view. Like, Lisa Kudrow, have you ever been in a situation where your part was shortened? It was, like, diminished and went from, like, star to, like, minor character? And you were told that by the writer.
Not sort of, and not exactly. I've seen those things happen, and I mean, I know for me that if something's not working, you know, the writers, God bless them, always come up with other ways of letting you know, you know, that they're going to change something. You know, I don't know. It just, that scene feels really real, very, very real to me. In that, you know, there's an actress who signs on for a role of, she's going to be one of four 30-somethings, shows up, and the network felt pressure to cast everyone else a little younger, a lot younger. And then, of course, it doesn't work. It's as if, like, people aren't paying attention to the intention of the writers and what they were writing in the first place, which was four 30-something women. And then the network said, yeah, but for demographics, we need younger people. And then you have, it's, you know, cast differently, and it doesn't work anymore. So they have to make changes, and, you know, Valerie ends up being this older joke.
The scene is interesting to me because it's everything in a nutshell that you need to know about Valerie. She comes in denial, pretending that she's just going to get a new joke. She, underneath the surface, knows that things aren't good. She gets thrown. She's greatly disappointed, yet within a matter of 2 minutes, she's decided to spin it to be, oh, I own the building. Oh, I know. Oh, this will be fun. Right. In 2 minutes, they tell her the truth, and she decides to hear what she wants to hear and keep going in a bad situation. Maybe a healthier person would have said, hey, you know what? Not for me. This whole thing changed. But Valerie's too needy. And on the other hand, that's the thing I like about Valerie is you can hand her a plate of crap, and she goes... Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I was hoping someone would hand this to me later. I just didn't expect it so soon. And isn't it a pretty plate?
Yeah. And it's a rich color. Look at that rich brown, and it's good.
Yeah. I love that about Valerie.
That's what I actually like about her. To me, her flaw is not how quickly she tries to adapt. That's the good part about her is, you know, she wants what she wants. That's her flaw. She wants to be the star again.
Yeah.
And it's not possible. It's not a possibility in this environment that she's in.
And no matter how good her scene is, no matter how good she manages them over the next 12 episodes to create a scene for her, she's always going to be standing next to a blonde 22-year-old in a bikini.
My guests are Lisa Kudrow and Michael Patrick King, the co-creators and executive producers of the new HBO comedy series, The Comeback. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Lisa Kudrow and Michael Patrick King, the co-creators and executive producers of the new HBO comedy series, The Comeback. It stars Kudrow as an actress starring in a reality show about her attempt to make a comeback in a new sitcom. Kudrow also played Phoebe on Friends. King was a writer and executive producer on Sex and the City. Lisa Kudrow, one of the things I really love about your performance in The Comeback is that although your character often doesn't get it. She doesn't get that she's as important, that she's not as important as she hopes she is or thinks she is. And she's not really picking up on some of the obvious clues people are giving her. But she still registers the hurt. She registers the pain. And to be able to do that as subtly as you do it in a comedy is really just fascinating to watch. Could you talk a little bit about trying to register subtle reactions in what's basically a comedy? It's not a drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what's funny to me is someone who has no idea how they're coming off. And, you know, the registering the disappointment or the horror or whatever it is, she thinks she's covering it so fast that you didn't even see that crack. And, you know, with a reality camera in your face, 20, you know, all day long, they're not going to miss a thing. She just doesn't have a clue. She thinks she's covering really well.
I want to play another short scene from the first episode of The Comeback. And this is during the shoot for the pilot episode. And this is Valerie Cherish's big scene, and I think her only scene
yes,
in the pilot. And what's happening is that Two of the young, attractive 20-something roommates are on the couch. The guy is beneath the woman. The woman is, they're both wearing like shorts and t-shirts. She's kind of straddling him playfully. And as they're like this on the couch, Valerie Cherish walks in. So here's the scene.
Oh, wait. Just because we're kissing and I'm on top of you does not mean that I'm open to a relationship.
Damn, forget the relationship. Just open my shirt.
Okay.
Note to self. I don't need to see that.
I love that scene. It's so bad. It's just, I think that scene just perfectly embodies what's really bad about a certain type of sitcom.
It's true that it's bad, but here's the thing. That line, note to self, I don't need to see that.
Yeah.
The original line that Lisa and I wrote in the pilot script was, get a room. And Lisa said to me, I think let's try to make this really a better sitcom joke, you know, because there's a thing called a clam in sitcoms, which is when you do a phrase and every show then does the same phrase and it's called a comedy clam because it's overused. And so we were thinking, like, what could it be? And then we came up with note to self, I don't need to see that. And we started laughing so hard. But the fact of the matter is that is a realistically good sitcom joke entrance line. And the sitcom itself, all those things, and the audience,
yes.
It's accurate to me. And it's really fun because we actually are writing a sitcom within this half-hour comedy. And it's fun to sort of say, and this is a potential another type of comedy that you can see within our show. You know, this as you said, awful show. Yeah, thank you, by the way.
You're writing a sitcom that you'd never want to write, and Lisa Kudrow, your character is starring in a sitcom that Lisa Kudrow would never want to star in.
Oh, Lisa.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Here's the story. Oh. That scene right before she comes in and says, I don't want to see that. I directed the pilot. We're shooting the pilot, and Lisa's standing out there waiting to make an entrance, and I look out there, and she's completely transformed into this other sort of fraught with emotion person. And I said, what's the matter? And she says, I hate this stupid joke and saying this stupid line.
Yeah.
And then she
I
realized she thought she had to make it funny.
I got a little disoriented. I was, you know, on a sitcom set about to make an entrance and didn't believe in the line I was about to say.
and her file just downloaded.
Yeah. And I just, like, obscenities are flying out of my mouth and, you know, like, well, now, so how do you want me to do it? Because he kept wanting me to, like, do it
I kept wanting to do it more
and
like a sitcom. And
but that won't be fun. That's not good.
We tapped into the cellular memory. Just like the very first day I walked onto our stage and saw the sitcom set and thought, somebody just put a piece of concrete on my chest. I can't breathe. And then I realized, oh no, we're making fun of the jobs that we have been trapped in. We're not actually doing them. We're trying to eviscerate our feelings about them.
And make no mistakes, that had nothing to do with Friends, by the way, because it was really well written. And our writers on Friends were really sensitive to if a line wasn't that great. Yeah, they would change it. They'd change stuff on show night. So it wasn't that. It was just
making something out of nothing.
Oh, my God.
Using your thing to make something out of nothing.
And I hadn't had to do that in like 10 years.
Yeah.
the sitcom within the sitcom and the comeback reminds me of the post Three's Company kind of program.
Yes, boy. Yeah, exactly. What these two writers, by the way, think they're writing is a postmodernist, Laverne and Shirley, Three's Company, Dada, funny, the joke's on you show. That's how they've justified it. They think they're actually doing a spin on Three's Company, but in reality, they're writing Three's Company.
30 years too late.
Well, yeah, but the bikinis are current. And the girls are young.
So what's it like?
So it's relevant.
What's it like to write the sitcom within the sitcom? That's the kind of sitcom that you don't like.
It's brilliantly liberating because it's a skill and it's a technique. And it's like making a sound. It's like speaking a language. Oh, that's what French sounds like. Oh, that's what that sitcom sounds like.
Oh, and Michael wrote full scenes for Room and Board. which would take him like an hour. And
but if
great.
I was actually working on Room and Board, that we would have been trapped in a room for 14 hours to write those scenes.
And then they even, you know, in the writer's room, they even came up with how Room and Board would start each week.
Yeah.
Where Cassie says, I'm bored.
Okay,
let's
blank.
Paint.
Let's go to the Beverly Center, dress as nurses. Let's, you know, I'm bored. Let's paint the apartment. I'm bored. Let's get Aunt Sassy a date. So the whole structure's in place. And we have some really great comedy writers that have worked on sitcoms and also have worked on, you know, one-camera shows. And so we all have a lot of fun trying to create the show within the show. And the whole first season really does track the development of that show and Valerie being mangled in that machine and her personal journey with her show on that show. So it's been a lot of fun.
Lisa Kudrow and Michael Patrick King are the co-creators and executive producers of the new HBO comedy series, The Comeback. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the most popular record in America and another that deserves more play than it's getting, Ken Tucker reviews CDs by Coldplay and Dressy Bessie. Also, a new biography of Mary Wollstonecraft and more with Lisa Kudrow and Michael Patrick King.
The hardest part was letting go. Taking part was the hardest part, and the strangest thing was waiting for that bell to ring. It was the strangest
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lisa Kudrow and Michael Patrick King. They're the co-creators and executive producers of the new HBO comedy series, The Comeback. They created The Comeback after the end of their own successful series. Kudrow played Phoebe on Friends. King was a writer and executive producer on Sex and the City. In The Comeback, Kudrow plays an actress named Valerie Cherish, who's starring in a reality show documenting her attempt to make a comeback on a new sitcom called Room and Board. Cherish's career had gone nowhere after the end of her first sitcom, which ran in the late 80s and early 90s. What do you both envision I Am It as having been like? And I Am It is the sitcom that Lisa Kudrow's character...
I'm It.
It's much cuter than that, Terry. Yes. It's I'm It. It's not I Am It. That's a sitcom created at Harvard. It's I'm It! Exclamation point.
I'm It.
I'm It. That's how Lisa hears it in her head.
So that's the sitcom this character used to be on before Room and Board. So what do you think of the sitcom as having been like?
Well, you know, I think of, and actually, you know what is interesting and another sort of fun thing for us is this week coming up, you get to see actually a scene from I'm It.
Oh.
We created a scene from like 1992 from what Valerie's sitcom would have been like. And when you see it, you get the sense that it's one of those shows where the single girl ruled and she had a office and she was a lawyer and there was a view of Manhattan and a cute guy in the office liked her, and you know, it had a feeling of a low rent designing women, or you know, wants to be Murphy Brown and wants to be anything but love. But that era, you know, where the hair was a little bit bigger and the business suits were bright, and the reason we put we attempted to do the scene is because we wanted to show where she fell to, mm-hmm. from the business suit and the office to the running suit and the sitcom.
Yeah, and she was the A story, and now she's the tag.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it was really fun to do that,
yeah.
too, because we tried to make I'm It as... or as Lisa says, I'm It! As expressive and as authentic to that time as we could. And Lisa, you know, is doing a whole nother sort of style of acting. And it was risky to show Valerie what Valerie thinks is good. But we went for it, and I think it turned out all right.
Lisa Kudrow, a couple of things that you do in the role of Valerie. You know, Valerie wants to be assertive. She wants to show her power, but she really doesn't have any power. Mm-hmm. So she has meetings with writers and directors in which she's really humiliated. But she'll say, mustering up all of her assertiveness, I need to know that I'm being heard. And it sounds like such the weak person's way of asserting themselves. And then she'll often like bow. She'll bow to the crew or, you know, bow to the director or whatever. And that's what somebody who is really powerful does. And she mm-hmm. doesn't. She just doesn't recognize her lack of power. And I love those little telling gestures that you have like that. Can you talk a little bit about developing those for the character?
Well, what, you know, the first thing that always came to mind with her, she's like that bad old-time ad guy that if you sell it and you sell it well enough, they'll believe it, even if there's absolutely no substance there to support what you're trying to sell. And so that's one thing that I was hoping would be really obvious, that she's just a little over the top with her, very assertive, and I, you know, demand respect. Even though it only comes up, she doesn't address it when she's actually getting pummeled.
I also want to mention something, Terry, that about the hands you were talking about, her bowing all the time
mm-hmm.
Earlier. We call those the yoga blessing thank you hands. And we laugh so hard because that also is a little bit of a virus that's running rampant in the actress community. You'll start seeing it a lot. A lot of actresses do the yoga blessing thank you hands to interviewers, to people bringing them their lattes. Suddenly the hands come up. Like, I've had actresses do it to me about when I say, that was a really good scene. They go, here come the hands. No, you. No, it's about you. But it's never about you. It's about you saying it's about you. So what we liked about the yoga blessing thank you hands is that it was accurate and goofy. She'll try to squeeze them in as she's going out a door. Sometimes you just see the tips of the hands as the door closes.
But it's also, and it's just, it's like, it's a phony gesture of grace.
Yes.
Yes.
And
yes.
Centered spirituality, which she wouldn't even know how to spell.
When you were preparing to write the reality parts of The Comeback, did you hang out on reality shows behind the scenes? Did you watch a lot of the reality shows? Like, what did you do to get in focus and in character for this?
Well, the first thing we did, aside from watching what they put on television as the finished product of reality shows, which God knows what that is, it's just their manipulation of what they want to have on as any sort of piece of fiction is. But we got a hold of some bootleg copies, illegal bootleg copies of outtakes of reality shows. And there were two things that stuck with us. One was a show where it was a decorating show, and they had redecorated a before and after for a wellness center for women who had cancer. And the thing that struck me about that was they had all these women behind a door, and they were saying, they were about to do the reveal, and they're yelling to them, "Okay, so when you come out, be very, very excited." And so the door opens, and all these women with varying stages of healing from cancer are oohing and aahing in front of the cameras because they've been cued to do that. Now, they would have naturally done it, but the whole thing seemed very false to me. And the other thing was a show, and what that gave us was the fact that the first thing we heard that was fascinating to me was the producer saying, "What are you feeling? Finish the sentence. You are feeling blank." And I thought, wow, they're really aggressive. And that gave us permission to be a little bit aggressive with the reality producer in our show, whose name is Jane.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right? That's so great.
Yeah.
You've both come off incredibly successful series. Lisa Kudrow from Friends, Michael Patrick King writing and executive producing Sex and the City. Can I ask you each to talk a little bit about the last episode of each of your series and how much input you had into it? Michael Patrick King, let's start with you in Sex and the City. Like, mm-hmm. were you in, you must have been in on the decision of who Sarah Jessica Parker should end up with.
Yeah, I actually knew who she was going to end up with. I wrote it and I, you know, heralded or spearheaded the movement to be Mr. Big, of course. Also, I was in on the decision to end the series. So that was one of my decisions as well. So it was very much a big deal to write the finale because I knew that I wanted to make the audience happy and I wanted to make myself happy and I wanted to make, mostly the audience happy. And plus we were in Paris, so there was all sorts of other exciting drama around that. And it was just a blast from beginning to end. It was a beautifully realized script by the production people, and I felt really, really good about it. And it was very emotional to write it. It was very emotional to film it, and I felt very satisfied when we were finished. It was a great goodbye.
It was great. That was a great finale.
Thank you.
And were the rumors true that there were alternate endings that were filmed?
There were. I wrote Room and Board scripts. I wrote three alternate endings. And we filmed all three because my the press was kind of crazy and about wanting to find the information out. And I really didn't want the party to be ruined for anybody who was going to be sitting and watching it on that Sunday night. So I filmed three different endings. One, of course, is the one you saw. One was where she married Petrovsky in Central Park. That was the TV Guide version that they had said that they were all going to get married in Central Park, and I was like, all right, that'll be that version. And then the last one was she was a single girl who was jilted and unhappy. And you know what? That was the easiest and most accurate one to write because it was the truest to the show, that she'd come back and have been betrayed and the four girls would have each other.
And how come you didn't do that one?
Because it wasn't the end of the road. It wasn't the journey I wanted to leave people on. I wanted to have the feeling that love is potentially possible. You can have a dream and it can come true, that people can be in different places at the different time and then all of a sudden find themselves together. But it was very important to me that they not be married at the end, because I don't think that was the message of the show. The message of the show or the series was find love in whatever form works for you.
Lisa Kudrow, how much of a say, if any, did you have in how your character ended up in Friends?
Oh, not much of a say. And I wasn't looking for much of a say, to be honest, because, you know, David Crane and Marta Kaufman pretty much took care of the show for the whole 10 years. And we all trusted them completely. So
at what point did you find out? Like, at what point did they actually tell you what the last episode was going to be?
I think we all kind of knew how it would end, but, you know, exactly what scenes and how, you know, exactly how they'd make it happen, we weren't sure. Like, if we would all just walk out of the apartment. And then there was a lot of talk about how we all walk out of the apartment and should someone take the, there was a frame around the peephole and, you know, there was a lot of
discussion about that. Peephole frame? Or did it stay there?
As a gift one year, I think set dressing gave us all a frame, which was nice.
Did you destroy it with your other memories?
No. I know. No, I didn't. No, but one thing that I got, Matthew Perry gave me something that is treasured. And it was something that was in the kitchen. It was a cookie jar with the face of a clock on it. And one year, one show, a few years ago, we were shooting and Phoebe, no one had really thought this through. Phoebe had to gesture that to something that, oh, look, it's time to go. And there was no clock available. And I just pointed to the first thing I could see looked like a clock. And it was this cookie jar with a clock face on it. And we shot it. And afterward, the script supervisor came over and said, You realize you just pointed at a cookie jar. You didn't. British woman. Anyway, I don't know. It made us laugh really hard. That became our little joke. And then he gave me the, asked someone if he could give me the the actual prop. So that's pretty prized.
Well, I wish you good luck with the show. And
thanks
so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Lisa Kudrow and Michael Patrick King are the co-creators and executive producers of the new comedy series The Comeback, which stars Kudrow. The fourth episode will premiere Sunday night on HBO. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the most popular record in America and another that deserves attention. This is Fresh Air. The most popular album in America and throughout most of the English-speaking world right now is X and Y by the British band Coldplay. Our rock critic Ken Tucker compares and contrasts X and Y with one of the lesser-known new releases anywhere, Electrified, by the Denver-based band Dressy Bessie.
About Coldplay, I am ambivalent. I'm not one of those people who dislikes them because they are hugely popular or because they make grand gestural music and are fronted by the guy who's married to Gwyneth Paltrow. I like their big hit Yellow from the band's previous album, no matter how many bazillion times it was played on the radio or as background music at sad moments on countless TV shows. In fact, the notion that a song could hold up to that much overexposure just showed what strong music creators Chris Martin and his Coldplay cohorts are. The new album, X and Y, has been getting a lot of comparisons to U2 for what their record company calls its, quote, huge songs that build to massive layered sound with lyrics that deal with life and death, love and loss. In other words, this is music about everything and nothing, but I do like the way it avoids U2's penchant for pomposity. When I was a young boy, I tried to listen, and I wanna feel like that. Little white shadows blink and miss them, part of a system I am. Coldplay comes by its popularity honestly. The band's sincere lyrics and meticulous craft is neither pretentious nor vainglorious. After all, they did premiere one of their new cuts on an episode of The OC. The only element I find annoying is that drummer Will Champion plays the same fluttering drum fill on nearly every song. But as the soundtrack of English-speaking pop music of the moment, stuff like this is attractively sad, morose, in an all-inclusive, we-feel-your-pain way.
What if there was no light? Nothing wrong, nothing right. What if there was no time? And no reason or rhyme? What if you should...
On the other hand, what person with a healthy heartbeat wouldn't rather listen to this?
'Cause you're bringing me down. You go on, freak out. Friend, you're bringing me down. So go on, get out. 'Cause you're bringing me down. Go on, go on, go on.
That's Tammy Elam, the sassy lead singer of the Denver band Dressy Bessie. And the band's new album, Electrified, is electrifying. Dressy Bessie makes zippy, wise, tart music. And listen to their drummer. This guy, unlike Coldplay's guy, really mixes it up. I listen to a band like Dressy Bessie after listening to Coldplay, and I think that I must be living in an alternate universe where the spunkiest, most life-affirming music is pushed to the margins to make room for the coldly played stuff that announces its intention to be life-affirming and then can't quite heave its huge ambitions into the position of making good on that promise. In other words, I think Dressy Bessie is a far more efficient pleasure machine than Coldplay. If Chris Martin's voice is earnest and thoughtful, Tammy Elam's tone is every bit as knowledgeable about the vagaries of love and loss, and so much more varied and witty in its expression.
Keep here with me starving, overtired girl. Let them think you're sorry, and owe it to the world. Turn it off.
So I'm not saying don't go out and consume the Coldplay album. I'm not looking to put down something that gives nourishment to millions. But if you've got the change, will you please cast a capitalist vote for Dressy Bessie's Electrified as well? Because in the pop competition to dramatize the joys and dangers of life, Coldplay makes all the right moves, but Dressy Bessie really comes through with the right stuff.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed X and Y by Coldplay and Electrified by Dressy Bessie. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of the 18th century women's rights activist Mary Wollstonecraft. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Lyndall Gordon has written prize-winning biographies of T.S. Eliot, Charlotte Bronte, and Virginia Woolf. Now she's turned her critical attention to Mary Wollstonecraft, a woman scandalous in her own time, who's now regarded as the mother of modern feminism. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Vindication, A Life of Mary Wollstonecraft.
I am not born to tread in the beaten path, the young Mary Wollstonecraft said of herself. The peculiar bent of my nature pushes me on. It's a rare person who really does deviate, in more than just a cosmetic way, from the received certainties of his or her time. But Mary Wollstonecraft was just such a renegade. Born in 1759 into a middle-class English family who barely took notice of her, Wollstonecraft was destined, like her sisters, to spend her life working in the ladylike shade as a paid companion, teacher, or governess. And in fact, she plugged away at all three of those professions in her 20s. But in a miraculous act of self-creation, she broke through the polite shackles of servitude to become, among other wonders, a social critic who held her own with the likes of her friend Tom Paine, a foreign correspondent who traveled to Paris to cover the French Revolution, a domestic revolutionary who had a child out of wedlock and then fashioned a marriage of equals with fellow political philosopher William Godwin, and the mother of modern feminism. Unfortunately, Wollstonecraft couldn't escape the most deadly of the master plots governing women's lives in the 18th century. She died at 38, soon after giving birth to her second child, a girl who would grow up to become Mary Shelley, a renegade in her own right. The larger tragedy of Mary Wollstonecraft's early death, as her latest biographer Lyndall Gordon sees it, is twofold. First, there's the loss of all those pioneering thoughts and books that she didn't live to generate. Second, there's the devastating irony that this woman, who spent her life sloughing off conventional female labels, became embalmed by them in the biographies written about her after her death. The worst culprit, Gordon says, was the most grief-stricken, namely Wollstonecraft's husband, William Godwin. In trying to defend his wife from popular slanders that she was, as the contemporary novelist Horace Walpole famously dubbed her, a hyena in petticoats, Godwin downplayed Wollstonecraft's intellectual rigor and instead frankly stressed her womanly hungering for intimacy. Soon enough, Godwin's full-blooded image of his wife was vulgarized into the tenacious one of Mary Wollstonecraft as a sex-starved hysteric doomed by her masculine genius. Gordon's just-published biography is called Vindication, and while that title most obviously tips its hat to Wollstonecraft's most famous political work, A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, it's also clearly intended as a retort to her critics, particularly those 19th-century feminists who found her too lusty for respectability. One of the many triumphs of Gordon's biography is that it makes Wollstonecraft's emerging life of the mind every bit as thrilling as her belatedly tumultuous life of the body. Gordon says Wollstonecraft found her voice in a brief moment of human optimism during the American and particularly the French revolutions. Throughout the first third of Vindication, she pieces together the long apprenticeship through which Wollstonecraft came to be, as she herself said, a new genus of human being. Some of Wollstonecraft's transformation process was jump-started by luck. She taught school in a town where the leading figures were dissenters, political and social progressives who inspired her. Other changes were brought about by Wollstonecraft's own gutsy acts of determination. When she was dismissed in 1787 from a post as a governess, Wollstonecraft set out for London and gambled her small savings on the hope that she could become a self-supporting author. Aided by newly discovered documents and by her own acuity, Gordon gives psychological nuance to the familiar outline of Wollstonecraft's personal life, her tortured affair with her shifty American lover Gilbert Imlay, and her remarkable marriage to Godwin. The two lived, not together, but around the corner from each other. As Wollstonecraft wrote to her new husband, "I wish you, for my soul, to be riveted in my heart, but I do not desire to have you always at my elbow." Wollstonecraft wasn't perfect. She was sometimes dragged down by inertia and despair, and Gordon's biography isn't perfect either. It dwells too long on Wollstonecraft's travels in Scandinavia and periodically halts the narrative to fill readers in on wearying scholarship, like, say, the Anglo-Saxon origins of the name Godwin. But overall, it presents a captivating portrait, not of a strident feminist, nor a blue stocking, but as Gordon asserts, a rational and vulnerable visionary who had the courage to try to map out, in her work and in her life, a blueprint for human change.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the forthcoming memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She reviewed Vindication, A Life of Mary Wollstonecraft. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Murder Ball, a new documentary about rugby played by quadriplegics in wheelchairs that look like they're from a Mad Max movie. This full-contact sport is a cross between rugby, soccer, basketball, and bumper cars. We'll talk with the co-director of Murder Ball, Dana Adam Shapiro, and one of the sport's top players, Mark Zupan. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.